Sociologists over the decades have charted social change here in the U.S. through a survey. We're talking about it on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. There's this long-standing social science survey that's taken the pulse on our social and cultural views since the early 70s. About a decade ago, the survey started including questions on sexual identity, and there are new trend lines to report. An increasing number of women are identifying as bisexual, but men, not so much. What do you think this says about the nature of human sexuality? Are you bisexual but don't feel like our culture fully accepts you and your identity? Why is that? Join in this discussion at 800-642-1234. Paula England is a sociology professor at New York University, where she focuses on sexual behavior, gender, and labor markets. Paula, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So every couple of years, this general social survey comes out. It's this data mapping of social changes, lots of data for you to look at. And one of the most recent ones saw this increase in the number of women who report they're bisexual. You've seen a similar change in your research. What do you find?
Yeah, the recent study showed in younger women, 8% were saying they're bisexual. I did a study using a different survey, also of the whole nation, and for women born between 1985 and 1995, 7% said they're bisexual. And an even higher percent say they've at least had one same-sex sexual partner. 20% said they were attracted sexually to both men and women. And these are, you know, these are big upticks from what was true before. So something's going on.
What might that something be? What do you make of these upticks?
Well, one idea I have goes like this. You know, we've had what we sometimes call the gender revolution, meaning, you know, women's roles have changed so much, say, in the last 40 years or something. You know, more women are employed, women are in jobs that used to be only for men, you know, women are athletes, women are clergy, they're in the military. So there's been a lot of opening up of what roles are seen as okay for women. And so you could see this as just kind of a part of that, it's always been seen to be gay or to be lesbian, to be bisexual, to have a same-sex partner as not conforming to gender norms. And in a sense, all the change that's happened has given women more permission not to always be conforming to traditional gender norms. And this might be just part of that.
So there could be this opening right now for more acceptance?
Yes.
What do you find for the men you looked at? Is the number of men who identify as bisexual higher among the younger generations?
The research that I've done and that others have done from this survey you mentioned sees some increase in men having had a same-sex partner, but doesn't see an increase in men identifying as bisexual or an increase in men identifying as gay, as far as I've seen. So it really looks like this trend is happening in women much more so than in men. And that's kind of interesting. And I think one reason for that is I think, you know, men and women that are not completely heterosexual may encounter what we sometimes call homophobia or, you know, bias against them. Attitudes about this have changed a lot, you know, like the attitudes towards same-sex marriage being okay have changed dramatically, the same survey shows. But in general, things where men are not conforming to a traditional gender norm, which says, you know, you're heterosexual and you're fully employed, you know, and you aren't the main person doing housework and childcare and all those kind of norms, and you're tough rather than vulnerable. Those norms about men have changed a lot less than for women. And I think that may be a big reason why we haven't seen as much change in men. biases against it are just so much greater.
We're talking about the latest in social science research on sexual identity. Paula England is with us. She is a sociology professor at NYU, where she focuses on sexual behavior and gender. With more women identifying as bisexual, what do you think this says about the nature of human sexuality? How have your feelings about your own sexual identity changed over time, maybe even decades, from young person to adulthood? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Paula, in the context of your research and researchers like you, sociologists like you, what do you mean when we say bisexual? Is this person who has had sex with both genders, or are there other stipulations?
Well, one of the interesting things about asking people's identity on a survey is that the survey question doesn't say, here's our definition of bisexual, right? It just asks people, you know, do you consider yourself gay, lesbian, bisexual, heterosexual? I think those are the options that we're given. They've experimented with giving some other options. But so it's a matter of what it means to the person, right? I can tell you that in the data, there are more than twice as many women who say they have ever had a same-sex partner and have also had a male partner. That's 20%. Only 7% identify as bisexual. So, you know, I think based on qualitative research, a lot of times what people mean by it is I'm attracted to both sexes. I'm open to having a relationship with either sex.
Even with increased acceptance, as you mentioned, of gay and lesbian relationships, is there still a stigma out there to bisexuality? What does that look like?
Well, I think there still is a stigma against, to some extent, against anybody in the LGBT community. But I think that there's also an extra stigma that may be faced by bisexual people, which is sometimes they may feel that they don't fit, you know, they have some bias against them in the straight community, but there's also some bias against them in the gay community. Now, the umbrella kind of movement of LGBT or LGBTQIA, whatever, has tried to, you know, create some solidarity between these groups, and that's often successful. But still, people report that they sometimes, you know, find bias in both communities.
From an academic perspective, do you see that there is more research going on in bisexuality than before over the decades?
Yes, and one reason for that is that among women, this isn't true among men, but more women are reporting that they identify as bisexual than report they identify as lesbian. And actually, that has been true for quite a while. It's not, you know, just something in the last 5 years. So, you know, if this is a phenomenon that's as large and actually a little bit larger than people identifying as lesbian, then it needs to be studied.
Looking at the ways that cultural expectations have changed as women explore their sexual identity and what this means for human sexuality in a broader sense, Paula England is a sociology professor at New York University. Are you someone who didn't previously consider yourself attracted to the same sex, but that changed as you grew older? What have you noticed? Why do you think that happened? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. Talking about sexual identity and why the percentage of women reported that they're bisexual has spiked over the past decade. One of the takeaways is that young people today are willing to explore their sexuality. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Have you noticed a big shift in the way people accept those who don't identify as straight? Men Do you feel there are additional barriers in the way of your gender, having the freedom to explore your sexuality? Why is that? There's time for your thoughts at 800-642-1234. And New York University sociologist Paula England is our guide on this. She researches sexual behavior and gender. Paula, if the increases that we see in bisexual women is because we're more accepting, perhaps, of doing things men would normally do, we're seeing more acceptance in our society, what does this tell us about the way we value things that women would normally do, like, you know, be with a man?
Right. Well, you know, that's a really interesting question because before I got into researching on sexuality, what I was studying was the sex gap in pay. And one of the things that I learned studying this is that in the workplace, the more the work you're doing is seen as a traditionally female job, the less it gets paid. You know, sort of after we adjust for like how much education does it require and things like that. Mm-hmm. So in other words, men and women in traditionally female jobs, say requiring a high school degree, get paid less than men and women in traditionally male jobs that requires a high school degree, and the same for a college degree, et cetera. And so to me, that does show some that the culture devalues whatever is feminine as seen as feminine. And you know, so all these changes that we've seen are sort of, yeah, women can do more masculine things because we always respected that stuff more anyhow. We just didn't let women into the club, right? Mm-hmm. And that's changed, and women are allowed to do more of that. I mean, they still face some barriers, but I think the devaluation of things seen as feminine kind of is still there in a lot of ways, in the workplace. And you could say that because men engaging in same-sex behavior is seen culturally as less masculine, that, you know, again, that's part of why there's so much bias against it. And that it's of one piece with the, you know, devaluation of jobs seen as more female.
Paula, let's look at pornography for a moment and how we've seen this making its way into our cultural norms. Do we see this devaluation of the feminine in the types of porn that has become so popular?
You know, I don't know if I would call it devaluation of the feminine, but what I would say about pornography is that in the main, it focuses on what's pleasurable for men, but it makes it look like whatever's pleasurable for men, women are just dying for too. But one thing that's relevant to, bisexuality, some people have asked me the question, well, in pornography consumed by men a lot, it's seen as sexy to have some, you know, woman-on-woman sexual action, right? And so might the acceptability of this, of women having female partners, be partly just because, well, men think it's titillating to watch? You know, I think there is something to that, and that may explain part of why we see, you know, heterosexual women kissing women on the dance floor at parties and things like that. It's more for men's titillation. But I think that most women who are calling themselves bisexual, are really interested in a private sexual relationship with a woman, not just titillating men. One piece of evidence for that is in this other survey that I did some research on, most women who say they've had sex with a woman have had oral sex with a woman, for example, you know, not just kissing or something like that.
What do you think this all says, you know, stepping back about the nature of human sexuality as a whole? Will we continue to see quite a bit of uptick and changes as you look at this data mapping as it goes on, you know, decades from now?
Well, it's hard to predict the future, but I might expect continued increases. I think what it really tells us is that sexuality is very malleable by culture, by, you know, social circumstances. Because obviously, if exactly how we were, you know, who we're attracted to and who we have sex with was 100% hardwired, then we wouldn't see change over time. You know,
right.
It's not like the gene pool of our nation has changed that much. Now, on the other hand, that does not mean that sexuality and who you're attracted to is 100% socially determined either. I think it's a mix of, you know, some people may be biologically hardwired to be attracted only to same-sex partners, some only to other sex partners, some maybe it could be open either way in terms of their biological wiring, but if the culture sort of, you grow up and the culture says, hey, the default option is everybody's heterosexual, then if that works fine for you, you may never question it.
Mm.
But then if there is more cultural acceptance, then some people who do feel the attraction may act on it, and the very attraction itself may be sometimes affected by social ideas about, you know, what's appropriate or what would be normal. So I think you know, both biology and social things are in play here, but the fact that it's changing is telling you that something about the social situation is changing, and making this more, you know, more inviting for more women.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about sexual identity and recent trends with New York University sociologist Paula England, and she studies sexual behavior and gender in her work. Paula, while we've just touched briefly on the gender revolution, the gay rights movement, making it easier for women to identify themselves as bisexual, what obstacles do you see that are still out there as we look at our society?
Well, here's a mundane one. Same-sex relationships between women run up, in terms of a long-term partnership, run up against the sex gap in pay, because instead of having, you know, either a man and a woman or two men, you have two women, and women tend to earn less than men. So that in itself may be a barrier to long-term same-sex relationships between women.
Is that budging at all?
The sex gap in pay?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it continues to narrow, but much more slowly. The big progress on that was really in the 80s, and since then it's narrowed, but very slowly. You know, it's still a big factor.
What might the Me Too movement have had in that pay gap movement, if anything at all? Has there been any research on parallels there?
You know, that's a really interesting question, you know, and I really don't know. I will say that I think the relevance of the Me Too movement, you know, which is mostly about having there be some negative consequences for men who essentially sexually harass women in the workplace, that's partly about taking women's sexual agency seriously, which includes the right to not want to have sex with someone and not be sexually harassed by them. And it's kind of a piece with the same thing if we take women's sexual agency seriously enough to think that they may choose women partners, and also that in heterosexual relationships, women's pleasure is taken more seriously than it has been in the past.
So there's a lot to watch here as a sociologist. Where do you think the research focus should be as we wrap up here?
Well, all sorts of things need to be studied. You know, I think that we need to, I would say a real focus is look at how this plays out over the life cycle. Is this something, for example, these women identifying as bisexual, fast forward to when they're 50, do most of them end up married to men? Do they end up married to men, but if they broke up, they might get a women partner the next time? You know, those are things we need to study.
Paula, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Paula England is a professor of sociology at New York University. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Talking about light trespass here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Streetlights, car lights, home and garden lights, illuminated billboards, all are prone to giving off this unwanted light that's not shining in the right direction or at the right intensity. And a study in the journal Science Advances found that basically all Americans live with light pollution. 4 out of 5 people on Earth live with the problem of artificial light taking over the darkness. Have you had to deal with a neighbor's light encroaching on your property? What did you do about the situation? Do you think streetlights or other outdoor lighting is too bright, or do you appreciate bright outdoor lights? Join in at 800-642-1234. Don Sanford is an outdoor lighting consultant. He worked at Wisconsin Public Television for 30 years, where he was a volunteer manager and production manager working on lighting and location. Don, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. How are you today?
Doing well. So help us understand, what is light trespass?
Light trespass is when light that is intended for lighting one area spills over and goes someplace else that it's not intended to go.
All right. So if you have a street light right outside your bedroom window, speaking from experience in my past house, shining right into your infant's bedroom, there's an issue there. That is light trespass.
That's right. And it's an unintended consequence, I guess, is the best way to describe it. And it's very much akin to going into your living room and just taking all the lampshades off. The light isn't any brighter. It's just going the wrong way. Instead of being focused down, it's now going helter-skelter.
How does light trespass contribute to overall light pollution?
That's where light pollution comes from. Because instead of having light focused at a subject, at a parking lot, at a front porch, at an architectural feature, planting on the outside of your house. Instead of being focused at that, it's instead released to travel straight up. And that's what people typically think of as light pollution, is that light is going up into the sky. And, you know, the Martians already know we're here. We don't have to send them signals. You know, they already know we're here. So it's just wasteful. It's just plain waste. It's annoying, and it's wasteful to send light up into the sky.
Don, do you think light trespass is worse than it used to be? Is it getting better, worse, stabilizing?
I'd say it's stabilizing. I think people are more aware of the problem, and I think manufacturers are starting to market fixtures that control this light trespass, and one of the things there are two things that I think are important here. It's not the brightness. It doesn't matter. You can put a lower light bulb in a bad fixture, and it's still going to be bad. And it's not the source. you can think you're doing a great thing for the environment by buying an LED fixture, throwing out your old incandescent fixtures and buying an LED fixture. If the fixture is improperly designed, it's still bad. You know, you're still not doing anybody any favors. You're just spending less money and still doing something bad.
So you really not only have to think about illumination and about what kind of light you put in and screw in, but you really have to think about the actual fixture itself.
That's right, because if you can see, one of the ways to know if you're creating light pollution or light trespass is walk across the street, walk over into your neighbor's yard, or if you live on a lake, go half a mile out into the lake and look at your house. And if you can see the light source or the source of the light, not the effect of the light, which is, you know, the light hitting the ground, but if you can actually see the light, then you've got light trespass. You're a trespasser.
We're talking about the impact of what is called trespass light. Don Sanford is an outdoor lighting consultant. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you taken steps to make sure your outdoor lighting isn't bothering your neighbors or perhaps bothering wildlife? What tips do you have to make sure your lighting isn't too bright? What questions do you have about how to make sure you're not contributing to light trespass or light pollution? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Joe now, joining us from Neenah. Hi, Joe.
Hello. I absolutely agree with the point being raised here. I live on a lake, and I live in the city, and there are people who buy sodium vapor lights who think they have to be eternally secure. They're afraid of anything coming on their property. But what they fail to realize is that there are side shields. There are devices that direct light downward on your property, and all you'll see on the lake is the glow of someone's property, but it will not spill into the sky. I suggest they go to the website of the IDA, International Dark Sky Association, and they'll learn what kind of devices can be purchased. But I do not appreciate a neighbor who puts in LED lighting and fails to put in side shields. Right now in the city, I do have neighbors like that. And you just see such a bright light, and there's no need for it. You can light your property with the proper lighting fixture, as was pointed out.
Joe, thanks so much for the call. Don, what about side shields? What do
They are most commercial fixtures come with side shields as an option. For whatever reason, the most common fixture that are put up on commercial buildings are things called wall packs, and that's a fixture that is attached to the outside of a building. It looks like a glass box, and the proper wall packs have a metal cover that come right down to the bottom of that fixture, so that the light is forced to go straight down. But that's an option, and a lot of times the installer or the architect, whoever specified that fixture, misses that option, and you create a light bomb instead of a beautiful lighting on the outside of a building. The other thing, the other place where you often see these issues is we call them bollard lights. They're these posts that are maybe about waist high, and they have a opening at the top with sometimes some louvers, but the louvers are not always installed, or they're installed improperly. Instead of the light being forced down onto the pathway, it goes out horizontally, and those things are conveniently, I say sort of with a wink-wink, they're at a convenient height, so if you're in your car and you're driving by, they're exactly at eye level for a driver, and you drive by one of these poorly installed fixtures, and bang, you get hit right in the eye, and when you get a bright light shining into your eyes like that, you're temporarily blinded. It's very hard to see.
Let's go to Jenny now, joining us from Germantown. Hi, Jenny.
Hello. Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind about light trespass?
I have a neighbor who has a security light that goes on and off with motion detection outside my bedroom window. if a rabbit runs across the street a mile down the road, that light goes on, unfortunately.
Oh, dear.
I counted 43 times one night before I got so frustrated that I just stopped counting. It wakes me up all night long, and I do not want to have to resort to light-blocking shades because I like to wake up to the sun in the morning. So is there any legal recourse for me with this?
Don, what are regulations that, what are the, you know, are there regulations to for light pollution?
Yeah, in most municipalities, there are regulations about light trespass. And, but they're, sometimes they're hard to find. Talking to a neighbor who has a bad light is like telling somebody that they've got bad breath. It's one of the most uncomfortable things you can do. And so you turn to a building inspector because, you know, that's what these people do. And I looked at several lighting codes. I mean, here in Madison, our the ordinances about light trespass are tucked into the zoning code. And the way you can find those sometimes is if you just go to your municipality's website and find the code of ordinances and do a search in there under lighting, and it'll be tucked in there. And there are measurements. The way that this is determined is that an inspector will come out with a special light meter and will stand at the property line, and there are measurements, foot candle measurements, that will indicate how much light can come across the property line. And usually it's in the order of one or maybe three foot candles, which isn't a lot. Or sometimes the ordinance will be written to say that you shouldn't be able to see the source or its reflection from the other side of the property line.
So you're saying that they'll actually take measurements to see exactly how much light is spilling over?
Right. There are measurements, and there are building codes, just like there are codes for everything else about sidewalks and the construction of a building and the way the parking lot is marked. There are codes and there are ordinances that are written to detail and describe what light trespass is and how much is allowed.
Outdoor lighting consultant Don Sanford is our guide as we talk about light trespass. Have you ever been out in nature with no artificial lighting at all? What was it like for you to see the night sky in the absence of any light pollution? Did seeing a part of the world without any light pollution change your thoughts on how much outdoor lighting we need? Join in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us WPR Mornings. We'll be back to this in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Our world is lit by electricity, and there are some words to describe different light pollution. There's over-illumination, light clutter, sky glow, light trespass. We're talking about light trespass here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Unwanted light creeps onto someone else's property or into another person's window, so you may have a light on your back patio illuminating your backyard. If some of that light creeps over the fence, shines into your neighbor's living room through a window, your backyard light is trespassing on your neighbor. Have you had to deal with a neighbor's lights encroaching on your property? What did you do about the situation? Do you think street lights and other outdoor lighting tends to be too bright or not powerful enough? Does outdoor lighting make you feel safe? Join in at 800-642-1234. Outdoor lighting consultant Don Sanford stays with us. Don, we had an email from Emmanuel in Strawberry Point, Iowa, and he said, my city went from mercury vapor to sodium vapor to LED. And he said, I'm glad we are back to blue from the orange of sodium vapor. Each change resulted in reduced electricity use. Can you help us understand which of these, what's going on here with these different types of light?
Well, the LED light, of course, is the most modern advanced light source and uses far less electricity than than anything else that was been there before, and using less electricity is one thing, but it's all about the fixture design, and because an LED fixture is designed to put out the same amount of the same number of lumens, the same brightness as a sodium fixture or a mercury vapor. They're designed to put out that same level, deliver the same amount of light onto the street, for instance, but it's in the fixture design.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's so critical. I've been in towns where they remodeled their downtown lighting and put in these wonderful fixtures that used I think they were sodium vapor, I can't think what the source was, but anyway, it was an improvement for them, but the fixtures are so poorly designed that they created all this glare, and the glare is the term when light shines in your eyes or in your bedroom or goes someplace or it goes up where it's not supposed to go. That's glare, and that it doesn't matter what the light source is, glare is bad. And the thing is that you know this intuitively when you're walking down the street or driving down the road. You know it when a light shines in your eye. Holy cow! Look at that light just shined right. That's glare, and that's not good lighting.
Let's go to Doug now, joining us from Loganville. Hi, Doug.
Hi there. I just want to make a comment. When I was much younger, growing up on the farm, so I'm one of a really, really big hill in Sauk County. And if you went out on a clear night, you could see the stars like you'd never seen before. And it was amazing. So much so when I got a little bit older and got married, I took my wife out to the same spot on a nice clear night to show her the stars. But, you know, there's a glow from the towns all around. In every direction, you can just count Reedsburg or Loganville. Those had gotten much brighter over time.
Doug, thanks so much for the call. And it's, you know, Doug can reach back to his childhood and remember much darker skies. Mm-hmm. Is it light trespass to blame?
Yes, definitely. And another way to think about this is the next time you're flying, you know, you jump in an airplane, you fly across the country, and you fly over a city at night sometime, and you look out the window, and a light is shining up at you. Well, that doesn't make any sense at all. Why is somebody paying good money to send a light 10,000 feet up in the air?
Right,
you know,
yeah.
And that light contributes to sky glow because the light source, it's uncontrolled, goes up and reflects off the moisture in the air, and that's what creates this sky glow that we see.
You're out on the lakes a lot. What does it look like from your vantage point from, say, Lake Monona or Mendota as you look back to shore?
I took someone out on a boat ride one night trying to explain light trespass to them, and it was a hard sell. Didn't quite get it until we were coming up to her dock, and she lived in an area up on the north side of Lake Mendota where it's pretty dark. And her husband heard us coming in the motorboat and flipped on the yard lights. And instantly, we were blinded. I mean, by then, we'd been out in the lake for maybe an hour, and our eyes had gotten used to this darkness. And he, thinking he was doing a good turn, turned on the lights on the outside of the house. Boom. All of a sudden, we were bathed in light. We were like deer in headlights. And she looks at me and says, I understand now.
You have this background in theater, TV lighting. How did the issue of light pollution come to your attention, and why did you decide to pursue this?
Well, in theatrical and television lighting, if you want to see something, if you want the audience or the viewers to see something in a scene, you point a light at it. And if you don't want them to see something, you trim the light off so it's only lighting that. And in a theater, we're trying to send light from a lighting fixture that's 20 feet away down onto the stage or onto the set. And so controlling the direction of light is critical in that line of work. And a friend of mine, David Liebel from UW Extension at the time, was working on a project, and somehow we got together. I can't remember, but he said, "I'm trying to understand this," and so we connected, and it was I discovered that at that time that outdoor lighting is just like all the other work that I have been doing during my career, except it was a whole new stage, a whole new venue.
So if you're feeling like you're a trespasser, is it possible to modify the lighting you already have instead of buying new fixtures or new lights?
Yes. Yeah, it's in some cases it's easy. Sometimes, you know, I've helped people modify existing fixtures with sometimes we've used a little bit of aluminum, especially the aluminum roof flashing works well. I mean, you want to turn the fixture off. And, you know, you want to be careful. You don't want to start running screws into a light fixture that might be energized. But you can add shading to it. You can't really paint out the lens on fixtures. Paint on glass just doesn't work very well. And sometimes it's just a matter. We retrofitted a parking ramp. We helped the owner retrofit a parking lamp that was creating incredible light trespass onto Lake Wingra. And all it required, I mean, there were maybe 25 light fixtures in this parking ramp, 30. And all it required was two guys, a stepladder, and a couple of wrenches. And they just adjusted these fixtures. And in the matter of an afternoon, the problem was solved. It was just... So sometimes the solutions to this are really simple and don't require a huge capital outlay to make everything better.
Don, as we wrap up here, what would you tell city leaders as they look to replace street lights, street lamps, and how they're installed in neighborhoods?
You want to make sure that all the fixtures that you install are full cutoff. And their descriptions of, if you just Googled full cutoff lighting, or another booklet that was published by Extension called Sensible Shoreland Lighting. If you Google either one of those subjects or you visit the International Dark Sky Association's website, you'll find model ordinances, you'll find samples, drawings, photographs of good lights and bad lights, full cutoff fixtures, and that will really help you as a person struggling with this. It'll help you understand that you're not alone, that this really is a problem. It's just not, and there is a solution.
Don, thank you for joining us.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me, Kate.
Don Sanford is an outdoor lighting consultant, worked at WPT for 30 years, where he was a volunteer manager, production manager, working on lighting and location. Stay with us. News is next on the Ideas Network.